and welcome to the Track and Food Podcast. You're listening to episodes, what are we at, 17, 18, 19?
I lost count.
You lost count? It doesn't matter anymore.
Well, we did one with the Chefs in the Hood event.
Yes,
but
we haven't aired that one yet, though.
Not aired yet.
No, because someone's been slacking.
That's me.
Yes.
I'm the guy who edits and produces the podcast and mixes and masters, so if it's not up, it's my fault.
This is actually our first, outside of the live one we just did with the Chefs in the Hood a couple weeks ago, we actually haven't sat down for about a month, so it feels weird.
It does feel weird.
Feels a little weird.
We usually, we've been fairly consistent.
Yes.
So for people listening, they know we've been started in February.
Was it February?
We've done every end of February.
Yeah, end of February.
And every 2 weeks since then. So it's nice to sit down with you, man. You're looking good. You look healthy.
And we just had some photos taken too.
We did.
So we will have some more comment on that one. I realize now that I hate my photo being taken.
Yeah, if anyone listening knows any professional photographers that want to do some maybe headshots or some action shots of Jamie and I for promotional material for a Track and Food, our podcast, Track and Food Podcast,
let us know. Do we really want professional? I don't think we want professional.
I know.
So, because that means we have to like look pretty and, you know, like not look like all haggard and shit in the morning. And
yeah, that's a good point.
It's not my thing.
But we do the podcast
before
noon.
Yes.
Today, anyways.
And I got here early today because I actually went shopping and I picked up some books for us today.
Yes, you did.
So if you listen to our most recent episode, we did Kitchen Confidential and we talked about Anthony Bourdain. That was the first in our Track and Food Book Club series. The next book that we announced was going to be Eating Animals by Jonathan Safran Foer. You know what? When I saw this, I didn't realize he was the one who wrote Everything is Illuminated. I didn't know that.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
This book has been out for a while, and Natalie Portman actually just narrated the documentary.
Yes.
I'm excited to watch that.
Yeah.
I'm excited to dig into this book, even though the font is really big, though.
I like that when it goes from the one side of the page as far possible to the other side.
Yeah.
I don't like it when it's like cropped in the middle like that. So I'm excited to read it, actually.
Yeah, no, I think it's
not just because of the font, because it's going to be a good book, too.
Well, it just makes me wonder what this is about. Like, is this animals eating animals, or is this human beings eating animals?
You know what it's about.
Yeah, I think I know what it's about.
Now you're being daft, Jamie.
Yes.
Before we go any further, I just want to give a shout out to Josh, who corrected you on your statement on the Anthony Bourdain podcast.
Oh, yeah.
By the way.
Why? What did he say again? I can't remember.
I can't remember. He was like, you were talking about how, what's the actor? What's his name?
Because we're talking about the movie. We're talking about the film with Bradley Cooper.
Yeah,
A Star
you said
is Born.
He like wrote like
yeah.
I was completely wrong. Like
I guess it was like it's a remake of a movie from the 1970s. So anybody out there who listened to that and wanted to, you know, smack me in the head while I was.
And thank you, Josh, for supporting our podcast as well. We appreciate it. And feel free to correct Jamie anytime. I love it. It gave me such joy.
Well, we're going to make mistakes here. So, whatever.
Whatever.
Why do you want to poke fun at me? We just started doing this.
Nah. Well, people can correct me. I'm wrong all the time too.
Yeah.
That's because our show character.
Yeah. My girlfriend says I'm wrong all the time, so I'm pretty much used to it.
Okay.
However, I will say one thing. Went out for brunch yesterday. Went to the Union. We tend to go there often on Saturdays or Sundays. Packed place. And I was stopped by our server as we were leaving, and he pulled me aside and he said, Jamie, are you Jamie? And I'm like, yes. And he's like, I really love the Track and Food podcast. Mine was blown, by the way. I apologize because you told me your name, and I think it was Derek.
Thank you, random server.
So, but he, I apologize, but thank you for the recognition. Anybody out there listening, we appreciate your listenership and following us and rate us and pass us along to all the people out there that are interested in food and culture based in Vancouver predominantly. But we like to talk about things like today. We're going to be talking about some stuff that's a little bit more broad spectrum. But all the support is great. This has been a really fun endeavor for us. And
I can't reiterate that enough. We insanely appreciate everyone listening and everyone supporting us so far. Like Jamie mentions fairly often, we have such a blast doing this podcast. So without any further yimmering and yammering and blibbering and blabbering.
Okay, so the first thing I want to bring up is a couple things. Canada's Best New Restaurants was a list just came out, I think, about 2 weeks ago by En Route magazine.
Really?
St. Lawrence here in
Vancouver. Wait a minute. So is the one that we did with Ron, it's the same publication, right?
No, I don't think it's the same publication.
Okay.
I think that's a separate thing.
And this one's an annual one?
Yeah, that's like an annual one. I think it's I think it's promoted that one by
That was American Express.
This one's also done by American Express. It's sponsored by American Express, but it's actually featured in En Route magazine.
Oh, okay.
So this is En Route magazine's top 10 new restaurants in Canada this year. St. Lawrence came fourth here in Vancouver. Big shout out to them.
A little slow clap for St. Lawrence. I know you eat there quite often.
Well, I actually went there last week, actually, ironically. I had a big hoity-toity dinner there with a couple friends last week. We had been talking about enjoying a night of Krug. I read a book about Krug about a year and a half ago, and I've, as a sommelier, someone who loves champagne, champagne's probably one of my favorite regions when it comes to like drinking wine. I mean, it is bubbles, but Krug, read a really great book on them, learned some stuff from Olivia Krug and their, you know, their blender and all the stuff and the styles and the history and how they, you know, how they use their back vintages. So I got really kind of intrigued by them, but I drank Krug before, but I'd never really kind of indulged. So a friend of mine who I work with, he is also a big fan of champagne. And we were both like, wouldn't it be kind of fun to have a night where we just kind of just buy a couple bottles of Krug, which most people are probably thinking right now is just kind of ridiculous because it's like $300 a bottle. But we did this and we were going to do this at a place. And one of the best things we've always thought about is just sitting there drinking Krug and eating potato chips.
Yeah.
So instead of doing that, which kind of sounded silly, we ended up going to St. Lawrence with another friend of ours. So there's three of us. And we drank a bottle of the Grand Cuvée. And we drank a bottle of the O2 and drank a bottle of the O4.
Mm.
Ashley Kurtz, who I interviewed for Scouts a year ago, he was cooking that night. Shout outs to him and the kitchen team and to Danielle. Danielle McAlpine, my apologies there. She was one of the servers who took care of us. And she's also the one of the managers there. She took care of us. We had a wonderful experience. It was awesome. Pork chop there is fucking so good.
You and your pork chops, man.
Yeah, I know. God, I love to rub that into you. Anyways, St. Lawrence, well, seeing them.
I have had the Krug before too.
Which
but one? Only because you turned me on to it.
Yeah, you've had the Grand Cuvée.
Yeah.
The Grand Cuvée is the prestige in the line. That's the champagne that they produce every year. It's fantastic. It has a huge amount of back vintage. The O2 and the O4, it was kind of interesting to try the two. The O4 tasted way younger, a lot brighter. The O2 really started to have a lot more development, which was a really interesting contrast between the two. Both are still very young, probably could have been sitting for another 10 years easily or longer. But it was kind of fun. It was a really cool exercise, kind of just to be in that environment, try having a dinner like that. The staff were really pleasurable. They seemed to be having a lot of fun with us, and they were really cool about letting us come in and just charge us corkage and all that stuff. So it's something I'm probably never going to do again, but it was a really cool, fun experience. But it was kind of cool to go eat there for dinner because I'd only eaten there once beforehand. And then seeing that they were put number 4 on Canada's Best New Restaurants, I highly will agree with that assessment. I'm kind of curious that the restaurants have beat them because St. Lawrence, I think, is what they're doing there, the style of food that they're putting out and the quality from the beverage program to the wine program to the food program is top notch. It's such a beautiful room, really cozy, intimate. And I think they're really trying to showcase something really interesting here in Vancouver. And yeah, so I had a really good time there.
Very cool. Yeah. So you drank your Krug and Grand Cuvée. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, the Grand Cuvée.
Grand Cuvée.
Yeah.
Cuvée. With a bunch of friends at a restaurant. I drank mine on New Year's last year at home with my cat by myself. So a little contrast in beverage enjoyment selection, but
so if there's any ladies, if there's any ladies out there who are looking to spend time with Mickey, can you please send your phone numbers and emails to him?
Disregard that, people listening. But when I had it,
why would you do that by yourself? That's so depressing.
Oh, I was tired, man. I got rocked at work, so I got home and I was like,
no,
I was
New Year's
gonna
Eve
go.
Parties?
No, I was gonna go to a New Year's party.
Oh, okay.
And I got home and took my shoes off and I sat down and I was like staring at the bottle of Krug. I'm like, I was gonna go to the party and share with people. I'm like, nah, I'm just gonna drink this to my head.
Drink the whole thing to yourself?
It's not that much, just a bottle of champagne.
Well, I know that, but it's
over the course of like, you know,
pretty amazing.
3 hours. Yeah. But what I wanted to mention about that is that it has this fermentation and these I guess what would be the best way to describe it? Like a yeasty.
Well, yeah, that's the autolytic
Chardonnay-y
flavor, right?
Kind of like base.
Yeah, because what happens
but
when
with
all,
like crisp, like kind of bread lemon stuff going on?
Yeah, because when all the dead yeast cells die,
yeah.
And that's why it's called autolytic, they sit at the bottom of the bottle. And what happens is they start to change the flavors.
Yeah.
And that's why champagne gets all that kind of bread, yeasty, kind of creaminess.
But I've never tasted
it. The longer it sits, the better it tastes.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Is this one was like unlike any other. Sparkling I've tasted,
yeah.
And it very much reminded me of this beer from a brewery in Bend, Oregon called the Ale Apothecary. They make one called the Latache. I think it's pronounced Latache. I believe it's like a body of water around that area, or Latache, and almost identical, because they do ales, almost identically similar profile.
Yeah, I mean that would,
and it's 2 year minimum age, and I get all that same really funky. stuff that I was tasting for the crew. I was like, oh my God. So it was a really cool experience.
Yeah.
And well, I only got it for $275.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much the price of it. And the cool thing about the Krug and drinking a prestige craft. So it's like only $275.
It applied in perfectly to what we're going to talk about.
Hey, we should do that one. Actually, yeah, it does. 100%. It's actually a really good segue. We should do that one of these days.
I'm good at segues.
Just sit there and just drink Krug while we watch basketball.
Yeah. So. Absolutely. Yeah. No Lakers games though.
Why?
Oh, if we have to watch a Lakers game, then you have to watch a Blazers game.
That's fine.
All right, fair enough.
So my Lakers got their ass kicked last night, so.
Yeah.
But shout out to Toronto. That was a good game.
Well, your Lakers actually beat my Blazers the night before, so.
There they go.
Fucking goddamn. 17% from three for the game. 17%. That's like almost impossible to do for NBA caliber players.
Especially with Damian Lillard. Like, what the hell's going on there?
Yeah, it was bad. Anyways.
So that was that. So I was really stoked on that. And then another one, actually, this is turning out to be kind of a wine related episode so far. Sean Nelson, who I also interviewed on Scouts, this past year, who actually just recently stepped down as the wine director for Vidges. He'd been there for 5 years. Good friend of mine, good friend of the podcast. We should actually have him on one of these days. He just won the coveted Somm Slam in New York City, in Brooklyn this past year in New York City. This past week or so. So I saw that and want to give him a shout out. Pretty stoked on that. That's pretty awesome. I know he's going right now. Ironically, he has passed his advanced quartermaster sommelier, and I'm foreshadowing, by the way, right now.
Yeah.
He is looking to do his master's. I think he's signing up to do his master's sommelier next year.
And no cheating, okay?
So why do you bring that up?
Let's do this by the book.
Yeah, exactly. So what Mickey's talking about right now is my column that I'm actually releasing. So when this episode comes out, it'll be about a week after this column's coming out. I'm releasing it today. It's a new column I just wrote.
It's out. It's out. Well,
it's out
there.
Why don't you talk about it?
It's out there, man. It's on the net.
What did you think about it?
On the line. I did. I thought it was very interesting. I have seen, so for people listening who aren't familiar, go check out Jamie's article on Medium. He writes about the sommelier brotherhood, I guess you could say.
Yeah. So what happened was, over the last couple of weeks, I'd read some stories and I'd been fed some stories about things that are going on in the wine industry. One was obviously I got an email in my inbox about a month ago from the head of the Quartermaster Sommeliers. They sent it to anyone who'd been a part of the court. Quartermaster Sommeliers, if you don't know what that is one of the highest governing bodies in the world when it comes to wine certification and education. You've seen the documentary Somm on Netflix, which came out in 2012. It'll kind of give you a good sense of what the court is, that documentary profiles for men who are looking to attain their coveted master sommelier. There's only like 300 in the world. The certification and the court has been around since like the late, somewhere in the 70s, I think is when it started. I think it's actually maybe the late 60s when it started. There's right now, there's like maybe just over a handful, like over 300. Pass rate is super low. Forbes magazine rated the master somm exam a couple years ago as the hardest exam in the world.
Really?
So what happened was, the quartermaster sommeliers, they just did their master exams and there was 24 people who wrote them. One person wrote ahead of time, but of the, I guess something had happened and there was leaked information that came out. And this came out. And so what happened was the court found out about this and it was information about the tasting exam because the exam split into three parts. And the tasting exam is considered the hardest part. So once they found out, what happened was they had to make a really big decision because this is massive when it comes to scandals and, you know, you can't have it where people are cheating to pass this exam. So they decided to nullify every single person who wrote the exam outside of that one person who wrote it ahead of time. So 23 people's now master designations were stripped.
Yeah.
So if you think about that, like let's say one guy cheated and you wrote the exam and you studied for a year.
Yeah.
Like I would be fucking pissed.
Yeah, no
I'd be
shit.
So mad.
Yeah.
Because now you're gonna have to retake it. You don't know when you're gonna retake it, and you know that for sure they're gonna make it harder. So that was kind of that was one of the tipping points of this kind of article. And then I read something about in Sotheby's, they had the wine auction recently, and five bottles of Romani Conti is Pinot Noir from one of the top estates in the world, sold from a couple bottles from 1937 to 1945, sold for over $2 million. I just read that and I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, this is fucking, like, this is just assholes. This just pisses me off. When I read that and saw that, I was just like, okay. And then another piece of information came my way as I saw that Somm 3, the new documentary of that documentary that I was talking about, the third one is coming out. And so when I saw the trailer and I'd read a little bit of information on what they were going to be talking about in this documentary, it just kind of brewed in my head about like, I'm like, where is the wine world going right now? And the newest one, they're talking about the Judgment of Paris, which was in 1972, which is kind of one of the It's basically the thing that put California and United States wine on the map.
Yeah.
It's basically all these wineries from the United States and California went over to, went and competed against some top chateaus in France. And the Clos du Val, which is a winery in California, beat and came out on top. And it kind of like for the wine world and everybody else was like, oh my God, I can't believe like an American wine was rated above French wines. And this kind of changed everything.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about that and I was just thinking about everything about that. And it just got my mind thinking about like, where's the wine world going? Where are we going as a culture with this industry? And it made me think that like a lot of things are driving this industry right now, ego and status.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, I'm like, is that good for the overall heartbeat of the industry? And so this article just kind of tackles that idea. I don't know.
I liked the equation to the documentary Somme because I saw that. And at the time,
and a lot of people probably have seen it because it's been on Netflix for a long time.
Oh, of course. But I think you're right. And that sort of was a launching pad moment for, you know, people who maybe didn't necessarily have a window into that world or the wine world. It's kind of almost similar how the information age we live in right now gives everyone the knowledge to be an expert, right? How we've talked about before on this podcast about like everyone knows how to make a cocktail now, or everyone knows what creme de violette is and all this stuff. Similar. This documentary gave people a window into like what a good wine should taste like, what the regions of wine are, the proper tasting notes. I remember when I watched this for the first time, tennis balls and fresh cut garden hose were like two things that I would like just so interesting to describe something that way. But, you know, to anyone who is a bartender or to an aspiring, you know, wine person or, you know, upper elevated sense of wine tasting and spirit tasting, watching a documentary like this would give them sort of like that sort of, you know, extra boost into that world. It's funny because, you know, so much of it is, you know, confirmatory bias at some point, right? Like you have this idea of what something should be or taste like, and then, you know, you, without actually doing any research or actually any work on your own, just sort of like confirm that to be true, right?
Absolutely.
So a lot of this things in these industries like cocktail tasting and wine tasting, even food tasting, sort of kind of fall into that path. So it was really interesting that that documentary gave people that sort of, in my view, that sort of green pass to be like experts now.
Well, the one thing about, yeah, and when that happens, a lot of things, and I'm not trying to take away from Somme because I actually really liked it.
Yeah.
And it's
it was
actually,
good. It was
yeah,
good.
And it, like
good.
I'd already started my wine studies before when it came out in 2012. So I wasn't something that like I watched immediately. I was like, okay, I want to become a sommelier. But I'd already kind of started that path. But when I did watch it, it made me realize, I'm like, okay, this is something that's really interesting. I love, like, I got, gave me kind of open up the world into that side because I was doing more WSET stuff.
Yeah.
But I can see how, like you said, if anybody watching that and was kind of curious about wine and wanted to get more into it, it's kind of like a launching pad. And that I love about what it's done for the wine industry is it's kind of opened up the doors. And even the second one that came out a couple of years ago, Into the Bottle, they kind of talked about.
I never saw that one.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was
that one's really good. That one's a little bit more about education. So I like that one. I like what they're doing with that one. And that one's about like kind of talking about like where wine is grown and how it's done. And, you know, a little bit of that stuff is a little bit more geeky and nerdy. So if you're interested in more learning.
It was. Okay.
Yeah. So that one's a little bit more geeky and nerdy.
So they're coming full circle with three, which is the more sort of.
Well, the third one.
Spectacular.
Yeah. The third one's kind of.
Showdown.
Like, yeah. It's the show off. And I just think. I don't know. I'm not saying, like, I obviously haven't seen it yet because I think it's just premiering. I think it's by the time this comes out, it should be out. And I'm pretty sure it's probably awesome and it's probably going to be really entertaining. And I understand at the end of the day, you're still making a film. You want to entertain people. You want people to be getting interested in wine. But just, and I love how they're kind of harkening back to the 1972 Judgment of Paris. I mean, that was a really big monumental event in, you know, kind of wine history. And they bring a lot of cool people in. Steven Spurrier, who is the decanter wine writer. Jancis Robinson is probably one of the foremost wine writers in the world. Fred Dame is there, who's one of the top master sommeliers in the world. You know, you're bringing out some really cool characters. So you're really kind of opening up the world to those people. So if you don't know much about who those people are, this can be a really great forum for you to learn about those things. So I do like that.
Yeah.
Just the ego.
Yeah.
The ego drives me crazy. And it's the arrogance. And it's the desire for status. When at the end of the day, 99% of people who drink wine don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
Like my girlfriend's father makes fun of me all the time. And when we order wine, he's like, oh, this smells like this, 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 this. And he's right. Like a lot of the things that you smell as a sommelier, you really get interested in about wine and the things that you pick out when like, you are doing your exams are kind of
cherry and black cherry.
Yeah, like are kind of ridiculous.
Because
like at the end of the day, fucking no one does that. You know, unless you're writing exams. So it's cool because you need people like that to really kind of explore and learn and teach about wine. And also help people to understand the different styles of wine. But there's also a point where, like, how much are we benefiting the greater good when it comes to like stuff like this?
Yeah.
So that was just something I was really interested about, especially when you see, because I find stuff like this can also glamorize and glorify people to give them a vocation to say, oh, great. It's worth it for me to spend $2 million on 5 bottles of wine that are almost 100 years, that are like 80 years old.
Yeah.
Which you're never going to drink probably. And you're only buying it for status. So that's where it kind of comes at, you know, this whole, it's just a positional good. And the idea of a positional good is just something that you want to do something to make yourself better than someone else.
Yeah. I was thinking about this earlier, and I think everybody has these tendencies. You know, for me personally, I'm really into tea, and I have this argument with my brother all the time. Shout out to Chase if you're listening. He drinks like grocery store bought Genmaicha roasted green tea, and it's his favorite, and that's all he drinks. And I sometimes will splurge a little bit and I'll spend a really exorbitant amount of money.
Did you spend $400 on t-shirt last week?
There's no need to like go blurting out actual numbers here. I enjoy tea. I enjoy an elevated tea experience. I charcoal filter my water. You know, I do proper measurement to get the optimal taste. So as much as I poo-poo the wine world, the spirit world, and like I do the same thing in my own life. So I was thinking about today. I'm like, fuck, man, like, actually do the same thing. It's just on a different scale. Right?
Yeah, but I'm not trying to like, but that's one thing I'm trying to get. I want people to understand when they read this column and what I'm trying to get at. I'm not trying to take away from people having passion about something and going and striving to be the best. If you like, I wrote the quartermaster exams. I'm like halfway there. I just have to write the advanced and the master. And I'm just like one of these people.
Yeah.
I just realized I don't have the level or the love to go that far. At one point I thought I did.
Yeah.
I was really serious about it.
That's the thing. There's this old adage and like one of these cliched sayings that everybody knows, like the difference between a $15 bottle of wine and a $40 bottle of wine, right? And everything in between, right? Mm-hmm. So there's degrees of what we're talking about. There's degrees and scales that you can go to, like spending $2 million on a...
5 bottles of wine.
On 5 bottles of wine. Or, getting a bottle of wine from liquor store that's 20 and it's still good. It tastes good. But, you know, again, it probably comes down to like how much money you have to spend on these things.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what it is. You know, and I even talk about that in the article when I bring up back in 1899, there was a guy who wrote Thorsten Veblen. He wrote this really cool book called The Theory of Leisure Class. And it talks about the rich and how that's exactly what they do. And he coins this term called conspicuous consumption.
Yeah.
And he talks about that.
Which modern times would be called pissing contest.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Who's got the biggest dick and who's willing to whip it out. So that's really what it is. And so I want people to strive for the best. You know, like I have a couple friends, like I said, at the top of the podcast here, Sean Nelson is a friend of mine. Mark Shipway is a friend of mine. These people are going to go for the Master Sommelier. I hope they nail it, and they probably will. They're driven, they have the talent, and they're very, you know, they should go for it. These are things that you should go for. I'm not saying that.
It's self-reflection is good. Yeah. It's good to understand in society why things are the way they are and how they got to the point of where they of how they are.
Well, and it's also the other one is just like, I bring up the idea of it's like if a classic example of this is when people go into music and film and to become an actor. Are you becoming an actor because you love acting, or are you going to become an actor because you love fame and adulation and stardom and money? Right. Because
fame and versus artistry. And money versus artistry.
There's a classic line there, right? Like, which one are you more driven by? You know, and you can tell that by certain people who are driven by those certain things.
Yeah.
So
that's the rub, man. That's the cachet. That's the catch 22. Is that there's another old adage, old saying that artists don't make money, right? So at what point does I just watched a really hilarious episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
I've never seen that.
Oh, dude, you have to check out that show. It's so freaking hilarious. For anyone listening, Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Hopefully, if you're listening to this podcast, you know the show.
Is it on? What is it on?
It's on FX, but FX, okay. You can just Netflix it, I think.
Okay.
Netflix, is that a thing? Yeah.
Yeah.
I just said Netflix it. There's a funny, funny episode where Charlie decides he wants to dress and talk like Richard Grieco, and they actually get Richard Grieco to come in the episode and film a quasi-softcore porn scene with D. Anyways, the whole concept of the whole premise of the show is what is considered art and what's not, right? So they just kind of like poking fun at the industry and what's worth like, you know, $1.5 million as a painting and what's not, right? Is it the artist's experience? Is it the life they've lived? I often get to a conversation with my mom about the greatest jazz singers of all time, the greatest female jazz divas of all time. And she always says Billie Holiday and Nina Simone. And I'm like, why? She's like, they have the richest voices. They had the hardest lives. Like, they struggled. Like, Billie Holiday was like, you know, turning tricks on the street when she was like 17.
Well, why do you need to have a hard life to
but
become?
That's part of.
Oh, because you have a story to tell.
Artistry, right? Oh, okay. So trying to relate that to this top, how much artistry is involved in this product, right? To give it the backing of being something that's worthy of, you know, $5,000 for a bottle. I think it all kind of weirdly relates because making wine is an art at the end of the day, right?
Well, absolutely. And the other one also you probably
making
factor in that is
making
also
a crafting a spirit is
how much
art,
is available too,
artistry.
Right?
Yeah.
The availability is how much is another big
part. Oh, sure. That's an aspect of it too. But I'm speaking of specifically the art versus money sort of argument, right?
Yeah.
So I know I went off on a little weird tangent there with the jazz musicians, but I think it all relates because, you know, is an actor getting into acting for money or is he getting into because he really likes making films or having his voice, you know, that sort of thing, right?
Or if he just wants to be Leonardo DiCaprio and get laid all the time by models.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah. But you can do that in your regular life too. You don't have to be Leonardo DiCaprio.
Really? Have you seen his batting average?
His batting average?
The man does pretty well.
What is that? Batting average?
His batting average is pretty good. Every girl's like a supermodel.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, that's just what you're seeing on the internet. I don't know.
Really?
Do you really know him? I don't know.
I think he'd be a pretty cool dude, actually.
He seems like
he'd be a pretty chill dude. So.
Yeah. Not just Tom Cruise. Brad Pitt, Leonardo DiCaprio, sure.
Tom Cruise?
Ryan Gosling, maybe? I don't know.
Nah. Have you seen that? Are you going to go see his new movie? That First Man one?
No.
No.
The wine industry and this sort of like pissing contest, big dick swinging money, you know, it's not just about the wine and about the art. It's about the availability.
Well, how come you don't
see
this?
It's also about, you know, big business and money. And these people who are buying these wines who can afford to buy them are. But is it the best quality wine? I don't know.
Well, exactly. Well, I've seen documentaries. I've seen and I've watched.
That's another thing. Speaking of documentaries, we never talk about how the genre documentary has become so fucking skewed and so different than it was 10 years ago.
Well, that's, you can blame 100% of that on Netflix.
Yeah.
Netflix is
reality television. I don't believe any of that stuff, man. Like none of it. Like,
well,
I don't believe anything that I'm seeing on a documentary or a reality TV show is actually happening. I believe it's like 95% script.
Well, no, well,
am I crazy?
Because you just asked, we just talked about the idea that we're going to be doing our next podcast and we're doing it on eating animals.
Yeah.
Natalie Portman is doing a documentary and you want me to watch it.
Right.
No, I think what you're saying is like, watch, I think it's the same line that everyone always says, whatever information you take it in, but then also do your own research.
Yeah.
So.
But a lot of people miss that aspect of it.
Are lazy.
I'm lazy.
It's what's the classic thing that people are going on right now in the United States with fucking Trump. It's like they just fed fucking bullshit.
Yeah.
And then they just think it's true. It's instead of doing your own research and realizing that it isn't.
Well, yeah. At that point, who's at fault? Is it, you know, these publications and news sources that are spewing the information, or is it the person who's believing?
Well, it's a bit of both because it depends what you listen to. If you listen to Fox, that's a completely different idea.
Yeah.
But if you listen to like some, okay, now
my mom listens or reads Breitbart, if you can believe it or not,
Why?
To get the full spectrum. Well, she reads everything.
Well, that's actually not a bad
NPR
idea.
NPR to Breitbart.
I will say
full
one thing.
Spectrum.
If you want to talk, like, I mean, because, I mean, if we're going to go on a little bit of a political rant right now, the midterms.
What have I done?
No, but I mean, think about this. I mean, that is actually a really smart thing to do because if you lean one way or the other, it's actually a good idea to learn about or read about what the other side does, because then you have a better sense of framing your argument.
Yeah.
Because if you only listen to, you know, right wing stuff or left wing stuff, you're only getting half the idea. And I'm not saying you're going to like the other side, but it's good for you to listen to it.
Yeah.
You know, like in Toronto,
and then you can kind of sift through what's complete bullshit, what are half truths, and what's like complete.
Well,
lies.
Like, and it's like last week in Toronto, they had this big debate with I think it was Neil Fromm or whatever, is one of these guys, one of the lead writers from The Atlantic, and then they had that. He was having a big debate last week with Steve Bannon. And you know, you hear all these people just clamoring about saying that they don't want Steve Bannon.
Yeah, I saw snippets of that.
Yeah, but they don't want Steve Bannon like talking. And I'm like, no, that's actually not what you want. You want good discourse. And he should have. That's what he believes. You may not like it, but he should. You need public discourse on people. You know, because then if you're just censoring his viewpoints just because you don't want him spreading his propaganda, which is bullshit, and it's, you know, fear mongering, and you know, a lot of whatever you want to think of it, it is, because I don't agree with it, but. He does have a right to, if someone is willing to challenge him and talk to him about his points of view, he has a right to do that.
Yeah. Well, and also he's an insanely intelligent person. Yeah. So it's beneficial to listen to someone like that, even though, like you said, you don't agree with their politics.
Exactly. No, but the one thing I'm always curious about with the wine industry, and I've written about this in the past, is why is it like you don't see this in the beer industry? You don't see this type of level of ego.
It's getting there, though.
Not really. You don't see people going out and being like buying, like, you know.
It's a different type of hierarchy for sure.
Yeah.
But there's definitely an elitist beer element, I would say personally.
Okay.
I wouldn't say on the level of wine for sure, but. You know, there is definitely beer elitism, I would say, for sure.
See, I would love to. You know what I think would be really interesting? Well, I mean, it probably is. I mean,
I'm one of them, so.
You definitely are one of them. You know, what are you going on now? What, 3.5 months now?
Yeah, 3.5 months. Yeah. For anyone that's confused right now, I have a reduced drinking program, which basically means I stopped drinking, essentially. Except for when we record my other podcast, which I'll shamelessly plug right now.
Beats on repeat.
With me and my buddy Tristan Young, who actually is the GM at the Oakwood, but you know that if you're listening to this podcast. Yeah, it's been a wild ride so far, but when I do have a beer or a glass of wine, I really enjoy it now.
Okay. I'm glad that you did.
Jamie's looking at me like completely
no, but I mean like
disarray of what I'm saying.
I mean, obviously the wine world has always been kind of looked upon as like an haute couture thing. It's, you know, beer has always been relegated kind of like more of a peasant type thing.
Blue collar,
whatever, yeah, you know. Absolutely. But I don't know, I mean, I'm not saying that ego is bad. Ego, you need some sort of ego and everything. I don't know. But read the column, I guess.
It's really good. Really, really good. For people listening, we wanted to discuss this new business model that's been popping up in various industries throughout our daily lives. And subscription-based product sales, essentially.
What Mickey's kind of divulging on is a couple things that happened recently. So right now, if you are a restaurant and you want to use booking services, the main ones you're going to be using for are OpenTable. OpenTable is probably the one most people know about.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Resy is another one that's really starting to pop up. So Resy was started by Ben Leventhal and Michael Montero, but Ben Leventhal is actually the guy who actually started Eater. So he obviously knows his way around the food and culture industry, but Resy was kind of like propped up to be a strong competitor towards OpenTable. Now, OpenTable is used for restaurants. I believe there's like over 50,000 restaurants worldwide that use it.
Did you know their net worth is like over 11 million?
Well, they were bought recently. So they're,
oh, were they?
Yeah, they're no longer, they're like a, they're, I think they're part of a publicly traded company. I think they were bought for like $2.4 billion in 2014, I think.
Oh.
But the cool thing is the sale of Reserve to Resy, basically what it does is just makes Resy more important. In here in Vancouver, I think only like 4 restaurants use it.
Right.
Yeah, I think like Tuck uses it. Farmer's Apprentice uses it, and a couple of, I think, one or two other restaurants. Yeah, they use it for reservation services.
But almost every restaurant uses it.
Well, every
as their actual restaurant seating software.
Yes. Well, yeah, and most restaurants use OpenTable. So OpenTable is the big one. You pretty much, if you go on the OpenTable app, you just.
Oh, you're talking about Resy, the new one.
Yeah, Resy's the new one. Yeah.
Okay.
So, but
the new kid on the block, the Coke to the Pepsi,
yes.
The GoBots to the Transformers, if you will.
But the one thing that I really found interesting about this is the fact that Uber Eats is really starting to jump into this market as well.
Right.
But also like it's game changing platforms for people in aggregation, and it's making things a lot easier. What OpenTable and Resy are going to be doing is it's going to be opening up the doors for a lot more smaller competitors, which I think are really going to be interesting.
Yeah.
But I don't know if OpenTable is going to change too much when it comes to their brand appeal. But one thing I find fascinating about this is how much they charge restaurants to use their service.
Yeah.
But then that idea was really interesting. And then when I was reading another article, how Uber Eats is really starting to like broaden their appeal, especially here in Vancouver, since we don't have Uber. But the one thing that I read an article talking about is
what's up with that, man? Ever going to get it?
I don't think so. No. We might get it one day. But the one thing that's really interesting is how Uber is starting this idea of, because I think I sent you this article from NPR. They talk about the idea of only the future and end of dining out, where like if you're a restaurant, like as I like to talk about these guys, Mammy Taylor's.
Yeah.
If you are only a night restaurant, if you're only a night restaurant, the idea of what they're doing is like they're trying to increase their valuation by using restaurants that already have a physical space and just creating virtual restaurants that you would use for these companies. So I feel like a lot of this stuff is going to be game changing over the next 10 years. But think about it, like if you're like a restaurant that's kind of struggling, or even if you want to just grow your brand appeal or just build your revenue service, if you're a restaurant already has all those tools, why wouldn't you want to create one of these things? I think it's kind of an interesting thing. This was something that came across me. I think I sent it to you, but like it talks about the idea of like how like if I owned a restaurant right now, you could definitely start something and like Save the Dishes, Foodora, all the stuff in the city that people use, Uber Eats, it shows how the market's changing, which I think is really cool. I wrote this a little while ago in an article when I talked about like the idea of Netflix for restaurants, where like eventually I feel like the whole industry is going to be changed so much with our smartphones,
right,
that it's going to force restaurants to have to adapt quickly.
It's a huge, huge thing. And I actually think that the movie industry was one of the first, and the music industry were one of the first on this wave.
Yeah, with Napster.
Well, when Napster happened and then when iTunes hit. So, you know, music was readily available at the click of a button, and it was revolutionary and changed the landscape. So artists now, to get people to listen to their music and to come to their shows, had to turn to what was kind of referred to as guerrilla marketing. There was a famous story about Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails had a contest at one of his shows, and it was for a fan to be able to come to the recording studio with them and like hang out and whatever. So what they did, this is like 2006, they staged a kidnapping. So at a Nine Inch Nails show, there was a van that pulled up. They already pre-targeted who the fan was that won. Get out of the thing, grab the kid, tie him up, put a bag over his head, drive him. The kid's like losing his shit, freaking out. Drive him to the recording studio, kick him out of the van, and like pull thing is like, hey, it's Trent Reznor and like Nine Inch Nails and like that. So that was like the first thing I ever came across as like a band going outside the box to bring awareness to their, not only to like their band, but like also their music, and to get them to buy fucking albums, because nobody was buying albums because everyone was downloading their shit for free, which they still are. Now in the movie industry, what they did was they started cross promoting brands, right? Marvel, DC, action heroes. Remember when the first Iron Man came out?
Yeah.
It was just Iron Man. And then all of a sudden, all of this shit, like Thor, Spider-Man. And sorry, Tristan, if you're listening, he's a huge fan of comic book movies. I'm not a huge fan of comic book movies.
Because they suck.
But what they did was they realized they had to start thinking outside the box in terms of marketing and promotion, right? So this guerrilla style of just, you know, doing anything and everything to get people to go to those theaters to watch those. Because remember, there was a few years there where no one was going to the movie theater, yeah, right? When all that shit started happening. So restaurants and, you know, big companies have to do all of this sort of like alternative outside of the box.
Well, that's like
thinking. If you look, right? If you look, really interesting.
Well, I mean, and a lot of the last few articles I've written about it, we're talking about that idea exactly. Like when I bring up the idea of a Netflix model for restaurants, it's basically exactly what you're talking about, the subscription model when it comes to, like, I mean, I'm a subscriber now of Apple Music. Every month, $9.99 comes out of my account and I can download all the music I want. I'm not lying. I could see this happening with restaurants where if someone created a platform like a Netflix model, like you're saying, with subscriptions, restaurants would just join on. You would just pay a flat fee.
Well, like, and you would Skip the Dishes is sort of like that.
Yeah, but that's
more of a service.
Yeah, but it's a delivery
that
model.
You pay if you're a restaurant, you pay a specific amount a month.
But I'm talking about where you go into restaurants.
Right.
Changes things. It's right. Game changer. And like certain things are like already set out for you. You can pick your table ahead of time. You can pick your so much more stuff. You can
like
rate
on a flight or something.
You can rate
going to the movie theater.
You can rate, like literally you can pick your table. You can rate your server. Like they can
rate
they,
us, please.
But also they can, but think about this, like think about a service like that where they can rate you.
Yeah.
Like rate you as a customer.
Yeah.
Like, and you can get a lot of feedback. Think about how it would change industry.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
It's like,
would you guys like that, listeners? Would you like to be able to rate your customers?
Fuck. It's like a Pandora's box.
You get into the
whole
territory of like, you know, you need to create revenue. You need to make
money,
right?
But this
you
whole
need customers.
But this whole idea of like all these things happening is like, you know, when you're talking about companies like Uber, which is Uber Eats is going to be changing a lot and they're going to be disrupting a lot of things, but it's also opening up a lot of doors when it comes to like, if you're, like I said, like if you're a restaurant and you want to grow capital, and the cool thing about the analytics and the information they get on from these companies, what it's doing is it's forcing restaurants to adapt and change. And, you know, the ones that are getting ahead of the game now are going to put themselves in position to be, I mean, generally the ones that do that. I mean, if you go on any of these delivery apps right now, it's all the fast food restaurants.
Yeah.
It's the ones with the big pockets. But if the smaller guys can get in there and they're smart enough, they see that.
It's definitely an emerging industry. Did you read that one of the major factors on these meal delivery services and like, I don't know if they're called ghost restaurants, but restaurants that don't really exist, or online restaurants?
Yeah, the online restaurants.
Yeah, so it's not actually a restaurant, it's just like an ordering service. Was basically from search analytics.
Yeah.
So people searching for something it not and it's being not available, being there.
And then they go, and then that company goes,
information being readily available. So,
but think what they can do with that information. If everyone's searching in Chinatown or downtown Vancouver saying, right, I want ramen, but I can't find ramen within 2 kilometers of here.
Right.
That company sees that and they go like this, and they go, they propose to restaurants in that area, but fucking make a ramen restaurant. Yep.
That's fine. I get that. But isn't that creepy as shit that fucking this information is being used for these purposes?
Really? This is the first time
I think it is,
man. This is the first time you've ever thought about information being turned around against you?
No, but like, okay, obviously if I search, I'm looking for a new hat, and
yeah, the next time you go on the internet, it's all hats.
All my Facebook ads are hats. Like, yeah. I get that. It's fine. So I guess my point is it helping society, or is it capitalizing on advertising and marketing for the gain of businesses?
Yeah. Like I wrote an.
It's helpful. Like, say maybe there's a wicked cool hat that I don't know about. That's like from some like AAA baseball team in the States, and I never would have seen it unless I got that advertisement advertised to me. But there's some traditionalists that would say that that's not how things are supposed to work. So you're supposed to find things on your own. But like,
it's not going
to
be.
I don't know. Maybe there's like a really dope band that I wouldn't have known of unless I was marketed to by a company like Apple that I wouldn't have known about that brings me great joy in my life because they're an awesome band. I don't know. It's weird. When I read that though, I was like, my initial gut reaction was like, this is creepy as shit.
Yeah.
Like,
and it's going to get worse.
Businesses based on this data, which is why the data is very
valuable.
Very valuable. Very valuable. Very valuable. NSA knew what they were doing.
Facebook and, you know, and Google are fucking running the world basically. Because they get so much information and so much, you know.
Man, they keep it all.
Well, they're smart to keep it all. I understand why they do it.
The reason why I like Apple is they won't release it. Facebook did, but Apple, they're pretty hardcore on their stance. Even in like criminal cases, they won't release information from someone's iPhone.
Well, because they won't even break open new phones.
So slave labor aside, good for you, Apple. I own all your products. Don't come after me. They're probably listening right now.
You going to buy the new MacBook Air? I think I'm going to get it.
No, just because of the graphics. I don't think I'm going to get a new like a 17-inch MacBook Pro. Yeah, something with some real balls on it. Processing power.
You spent $3,000 on a computer?
Yeah.
The stuff with, you know, Reserve, Open Table, stuff like that. I think it's interesting.
For most,
what's funny is when I was reading that article, do you know that over 75% of people that make reservations for restaurants still in North America do it by the phone?
That blew
my mind.
People are scared of the internet, man.
That blew my mind. I was like, really? I was like, who uses the
phone? Until a few generations die off, people are still going to do that.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So. But also people want to talk to a person, right?
I don't know. Do you want to talk to someone who want to make a reservation? Why? You can make a reservation
plus,
now.
Plus,
it's so
people,
quick.
Technology fails often, right? So say you go to make a reservation and then, oh, sorry, we didn't get that. Yeah. At least if you call, you're like, yo, I spoke to Sally. That's why people always ask for your name, right? So they have someone to blame when things go wrong.
My buddy, he does that.
My other question is, why would you want to use a meal delivery service?
Like, I have a friend of mine who's actually like done this many times when he's hungover. He'll like use Skip the Dishes, and he was like, he's told me he's used it 4 times in one day.
Right.
The charges, I was looking at the research here, for Uber Eats, they charge $3.99 per delivery every time that you use it here in Vancouver. Right. They now go to everywhere pretty much. When they first started here last year in December, they were only going to downtown Vancouver. Now they're pretty much going everywhere outside of like Delta and stuff like this. They charge $3.99, but I think they charge you sometimes when it's like peak hours on certain things.
Yeah. And then credit card fees.
But then you got to pay credit card fees. Yeah. You got to pay tip.
Yep. Yeah.
And then there's taxes.
Yep.
And then whatever the fuck the food costs like.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you, my mind just goes like this. You really got to be lazy.
Right. I mean, you're hungover. I get it. You just want things right away. You want to get your food right away. You want to watch your movie right away. But in terms of like the average person who's like, you know, has a family, you know, I just think there's,
why would you order? Why would you order Skip the Dishes?
Lazy as hell.
But why would you order Skip the Dishes? Get 2 burgers from Five Guys and 2 things of fries and 2 cokes and pay $42.
Because you have the money and you're lazy as hell.
What a waste of money. Oh my God.
But I mean, like you can't say that you've done the exact same thing. Like that would be like ridiculous. Obviously we've all done that. We've all been lazy. We've all been hungover. But you know, moving forward, like I instantly think of the movie WALL-E where like we have these like blimp people on these chairs just being fucking floated everywhere and food just like fed to your,
like, do you think
fed
it's eventually-
right into your gullet with no work whatsoever, no movement.
Do you think
no physical activity whatsoever? But I think we're going that way slowly.
Do you think the future of this delivery model service idea is going to be through drones?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think they're going to eventually move away from like actual delivery drivers?
Yeah, remove human error. Makes so much sense.
Well, I mean, it's also going through the sky. It's faster.
into the sky is faster.
Like, that does make sense.
Yeah, that's kind of weird
seeing, kind of weird seeing food just flying around.
Yeah, and we'll have tubes everywhere, right?
Okay.
Tubes.
But here's a
attached to every home. You install your when you build a house, you install plumbing. You install a food tube for delivery services that are like part of our culture now. This is like 30 years down the road, but I'm excited for the future, man.
Okay, so if let's say you're living in Vancouver, and say someone came up with a Netflix model for Vancouver restaurants. Let's say, would you subscribe to something like that?
How would it work, though?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's probably scale idea things. Like, you'd probably pay for the subscription service. You would get access to certain things.
Right.
Depending on how much money you want to spend.
Like, say there's like a certain select reserve wine list or something.
Or
like
maybe,
that,
yeah.
That you have to subscribe to as a restaurant owner to get access to it. And it's like the most premium or most organic whatever.
And this thing also could, like, you could pick your seats, you could pick your...
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, you could pick...
So the liquor store, the liquor BCL would be involved? Man.
Well, yeah, I'm saying this, I don't know. I mean, obviously there's a lot of analytics here saying you could work out, but I just think it'd be an interesting model to kind of think about. But I feel like something like this is on its way because you already see it with Uber, you already see it with Airbnb.
It's worked.
You see it.
You see it. Apple was like the first one, man.
Apple.
The first
you see
one
it with you
iTunes.
See it with Spotify. People love
absolutely.
It. And, you know, I mean, you already kind of see it with, like, you know, going on there. But like, if you had every restaurant and they all had kind of similar ideas, I mean, you see a lot of days nowadays with happy hour apps, but you'd be paying for it and you'd be getting a lot of, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's an idea.
Yeah. Well, stay tuned because the world is changing rapidly around us. We're trying to make sense of it all.
It's the phone, man. It's the fucking phone. The phone is changing everything. The phone is really making our lives completely different. And the food and restaurant industry is probably one of the slowest adapting industries when it comes to most things, especially with technology.
So for people listening, we actually were lucky enough to, and we've talked about it many times, to be a part of the Chefs in the Hood event.
Happened on October 20th. It was fantastic. We had a great time. Congratulations,
which is actually,
Bruce and TJ.
Yeah. Congratulations, dudes. I know they're listening, actually, because they listen to our podcast. What's up? And it was a great event. We had a great time. We actually did a live recording of the podcast as well, which we will be...
Airing a bit of.
So look out for that. We're not sure if we're going to actually tack it on to an episode or if we're just going to have a little sort of mini 20-minute, half-an-hour episode up. But keep an eye on that. It was fun.
I went to Kisatanto again this week. Thank you, James. Had a great time there.
Oh, was, yeah. Let's just like spend like the last 5 minutes just shout-outing everybody.
No, I don't want to do that. Because since the last time we recorded, I've gone to St. Lawrence. I went to Kisa. Where else did I go to?
I went to Arbor.
Oh, you went to Arbor?
Yeah.
Good?
Amazing. Oh, so good.
Yeah, food good there. Yep. I'm excited. Good. Sean Layton, new restaurant.
Como. Yes, when are we going?
It's not open yet. Soon.
Okay,
I feel like they're like
quite backlog.
I feel like they're like a week or two away. They've hired some really good staff there, by the way.
Awesome.
Yeah, shout out to Chris Betts, good friend of mine. Used
Excellent.
To work at Laboratoire.
Yep.
Also, do check us out on iTunes and Stitcher as always. Rate us, please follow us. Pass us along to all your friends. Check us on Instagram. We're going to be hopefully posting some cool photos. We took some interesting photos today. We had some fun with that. And new logos out.
They're not nude photos, just in case you're wondering.
That's
We're
it
fully
new.
Closed.
Is it new? Is it
no,
new?
Just for people listening. I don't know. That was kind
and the logo's
way
good.
You said that.
Mick finally finished the logo. It looks good. Check out the website.
In progress.
Yeah. No. No. We gotta settle on one.
It's looking good. Yeah. I might add some grapes or something.
Fuck six.
We'll see. Whatever.
Okay. We'll check you out next time. Have a good day.